For centuries, music was created by strumming strings, blowing horns, and banging drums. But at the turn of the 20th century, innovations in science, technology, and entertainment rolled into one to fuel a creative revolution in radio, in film, and of course, in music. And while inventions such as the phonograph and gramophone enabled us to record and listen to music for the first time in human history, technology was about to change music itself. I'm Nick Mason. I play drums in Pink Floyd, and you're listening to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. On this week's programme, we're shining a light on some of the pioneers of electronic music, the inventors and artists who created tones and timbres which had never previously existed, could never have existed, before we learned to harness the physical phenomena of electricity.
Around the turn of the last century, so around 1900, there were already quite a number of prototype electronic devices, but it's a continuation of experimentation. You could even lead it back to 1800, to Johann Wilhelm Ritter, who was experimenting with the physiological effects of electric current on the body. So one of the things he did was plug the electrodes from a battery, one into one ear, the other into the other ear, to see what happened. It was extraordinarily painful, apparently, and he managed to discover that things tasted a bit weird for a while afterwards. Now, that's probably the most primeval electronic music you could possibly imagine. It was when you get to around 1900, theories have developed. More experimentation is just waiting to happen.
Many of the early electronic instruments were based around existing instruments, such as the violin or the piano, but they remained curious one-offs. Sean Williams from the Open University.
One of the biggest ones, I suppose, is the telharmonium, designed by Thaddeus Cahill between 1904 and 1914 or 15, around that sort of time. Weighed about 200 tons, but it was installed in New York in a building, and it worked on these gigantic revolving metal drums, which would generate an electronic pulse. And music was played on this device and piped through to hotels or subscribers on the telephone network. You've kind of got the precursor almost to current music streaming services. Later versions actually used radio to transmit music to listeners. It wasn't terribly successful in the end because actually the radio signals were interfering with US Navy traffic, so they put a stop to it.
So the telharmonium, like many early electronic instruments, had a short shelf life. With the lack of any live performance element, kind of tough when you're a 200-ton machine stuck in a basement, it was difficult to build a fan base in an era when live concerts were key to building a buzz. But a young Russian physicist was about to change that. Born in St. Petersburg, Lev Terman, or Leon Theremin as he would become known, was raised in a home which celebrated art and science in equal measure.
This cosmopolitan view over different areas of life let him make his fascinating inventions because he could bring the art and science together.
Lydia Kavanagh is a descendant of Leon Theremin.
Because he played the cello from as he was a child, and actually later he studied at the conservatory as well, he knew, as a child, he already knew that there's some discomfort in bringing this romantic music and romantic sounds by such a physical, hard work activity on the strings, on the cello and the bow and the big instrument. And very early he already had this idea that he would have to look for any possibility to invent a new musical instrument.
Leon Theremin's interest in physics took him to university, though his studies were interrupted by the First World War. Beginning his military service in 1916, he moved through the Russian army's technical schools and became a high-ranking radio engineer, experience which would prove fortuitous when he returned to his studies. Tom Ray is an historian of electronic music.
Anybody that had played with old radio, when you put your hands toward the elements of an old radio, it'll often do what's heterodyning, it'll make these, you know, these kinds of sounds. But Theremin reasoned, well, I could make a musical instrument this way, and he indeed did.
Electromusicalный инструмент Theremin Vox – это первый инструмент такого типа.
This is Leon Theremin demonstrating his instrument, playing it, as was often the case, with a piano accompaniment.
When you have a radio field, an electromagnetic field, he found that he could move his arms in different sorts of ways, and that would have an effect on what was flowing through the circuit. And that led to him developing the instrument that bears his name, the theremin. It's a very, very simple instrument. You don't actually touch it to make music.
So how does that work then? Put simply, the theremin has two antennae. A horizontal one, which is looped, a bit like a shepherd's crook, and a straight, vertical one. Waving your hands in the air between these two antennae is what controls the sound. To explain more, here's Lydia Kavanagh, who was taught to play the theremin by Leon Theremin himself.
Actually, the antenna doesn't see what you are moving, so it reacts to anything that changes the capacity of electric field around it. And if I breathe, so that's the change of my breath, you see. I can play with my head, with any part of my body, but obviously my fingers and my hand is more flexible and more fine in the movements. And the basics for playing is to move the hands near the antenna. The antenna on the left, I raise my hand away from the antenna and increase the volume of the sound. So by moving my other hand near the vertical antenna, I change the pitch of the sound. So if I go closer to the antenna with my right hand, the pitch is getting higher, the higher pitch. Very close to the antenna, it's like a mosquito. And away from the antenna, the sound gets lower, lower, and lower. Up to the frequencies that the speaker can do.
When Leon Theremin unveiled his invention in 1919, it quickly caught the attention of Russia's new leader, Vladimir Lenin, who had assumed power a couple of years earlier after the October Revolution. Lenin had a vision to modernize Russia, transforming the fortune of the country's working class through technology, bringing the wonder of electricity to the masses. Presented with this futuristic new instrument, Lenin saw the PR potential in recruiting theremin to promote the new Russia.
Well, at that point, it was just the beginning of development of electrification in the industry. So that was something that needed to be promoted. And theremin concerts were the best way to promote the electricity. And of course, after the revolution, there were all these ideas about how the new art for new society should be created.
By the end of the 1920s, the fascination with Leon Theremin's instrument reached beyond Russia, and he began to find international fame.
He took the instrument to France, for instance, and that's where his name was gallicized to Leon Theremin from Lev Theremin. And it was a big success, huge success. The halls there, about 1928, he was received extremely warmly, and now he's on his world tour. You know, so he has to come to New York, and he was received wonderfully there. He's playing the theremin to 10,000 people at Lewisohn Stadium.
Theremin lived in New York for the next decade and taught a number of classical musicians to play his instrument. By far the most successful of these protégés was Clara Rockmore, regarded as a true virtuoso of the theremin. Tom Ray.
She took up the theremin, was immensely successful. The most novel, unusual, and hardest to play instrument that's ever been made. Because you don't touch anything. And she had perfect pitch. She was made for the theremin. You know, some people just wave their hand at a theremin. That's amateur hour. Clara worked out these aerial ballistics, if you will, with her hands. She called it her aerial fingering. Very difficult to master. So her performances still stand the test of time today.
And Leon Theremin turned his hand to creating several new instruments too.
When you have a hit, you have to expand the market. So Theremin had a keyboard. He also had a theremin cello, which was essentially a ribbon, if you will, that you slide your finger up and down. But the most novel of all these was the terpsichore. Terpsichore, of course, being the goddess of dance. And you danced on this stage to make music. So by bending and stooping and waving your arms, you could play the terpsichore. Needless to say, there weren't that many people who played the terpsichore.
Theremin's celebrity was cut short. He had irked the authorities back in his homeland of Russia and was kidnapped by the security service and sent to a Russian labor camp, a gulag, for re-education. His invention, the theremin, still found new fans, but it never truly became mainstream, largely because it was so hard to play. Still, it set a path for future inventors who used similar technology, namely the oscillator, a crucial device in the early development of electronic instruments.
Everybody's experienced a howl at a stage when the microphones feed back into the speakers and there's a continuous loop. It reinforces infinitely, 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 and then it breaks into a very loud howl. That's the nub of it. That's the essence of what oscillators do. They are feedback instruments. That was basically how we began making sound with electronics.
And the key component is the vacuum tube, also known as a valve, which brought the oscillator under control.
You can think of a valve as being a switch, but it's also an amplifier. That's a key device that then allows the design of all sorts of complicated electronics. So you can start to amplify signals, you can start to design circuits that create sound themselves, and then the floodgates are open.
Throughout the 1930s, experiments with oscillators and vacuum tubes led to more fine-tuned electronic sounds, though many of the new instruments were more ordinary looking than the touchless theremin, following a more traditional piano-style design.
Hard on the heels of the theremin is the onde Martineau. O-N-D-E-S means waves in French. Martineau is the name of Maurice Martineau.
You see, it's a real musical instrument without string or wind.
This is Maurice Martineau giving a demonstration in 1934.
The sound is produced electrically by means of radio valve.
Maurice Martineau, first of all, was a radio operator during the war, First World War. Radio telegraphy required a button, whether Morse code or anything else, and that idea eventuated in as a piece of the Martineau.
I notice you play with one finger only. That's right, because it's the easiest way. You see, it's not necessary to touch the keyboard.
So he had this instrument, which originally had a dummy keyboard and just this kind of wire that went across the keyboard and went inside and went around some pulleys and changed these capacitors. That's how this worked. And then eventually he had a real keyboard and the touch button.
Will you play some effects? Yes, certainly. Here is a trumpet. And bird, if you will.
In these early days of electronic music, success was often measured on how seriously you were taken by the musical establishment. While the Ong Martineau could make quirky sounds that emulated birds singing, its inventor, Maurice Martineau, also sought institutional support from the schools which taught classical music.
One of the reasons electronic musical instruments don't have a repertoire is they're not taught and the music is not written down all too often. There's a small repertoire for the theremin. On the other hand, there are hundreds of pieces in the repertoire for the Ong Martineau. It's the repertory champ. It was taught at the Paris Conservatory, and composers knew there would be experts who would be able to play it, and they wrote for it, and they wrote it into their music.
And into the 1940s, inspired by the Ong Martineau, new instruments emerged with an even broader palette of sounds and effects, expanding the musical range of electronic music. Among them is another French invention, the andioline.
So this little instrument is sitting here. It is a very elegant little sort of wooden construction, like a little piece of furniture with a three-octave keyboard. It hasn't been tuned for a little while, so unfortunately I think it'll be a little out of scale.
Wally DeBakker is a Grammy Award-winning musician who makes music under the name Gautier.
What have I got here? It has these little switches on the front that are lettered from A through to K. So I've switched down a few of these letters. I've switched down B, G, and I on the instrument. And this is kind of high in the andioline's register. And if I press down a key, you don't hear anything until I push this knee lever up. So there you get a sound. But you can waggle the keyboard from side to side and get a really beautiful vibrato. You can go quite narrow with it, or you can go quite serious. So there's a lot you can do with it. Probably hearing a lot of clunks and ticks from the keyboard and the knee lever moving. So as you can hear, it's a very mechanical instrument, especially if you put this switch marked P down for percussion, then you can hit this little ribbon that's suspended in front of a keyboard. So you can play like rhythms. Well, I mean, I really like the andioline can speak in a really nice honky kind of horn way down low. You know, can sort of emulate overblowing on a horn, I guess. It's got a cool tremolo circuit as well. When you put the D switch down, you can get these kind of tremolo sounds. And you can get different speeds of them. Slightly faster. One of the cool things is these little switches, if you keep one of your hands free, you can sort of change timbres by flicking them up and down while you're playing across melodies. I mean, for an instrument designed in the 1940s, kind of sounds like, it anticipates acid house type of sounds from the late 80s. So I think there's a lot untapped in the andioline.
The andioline was invented by a Frenchman, Georges Jenny, who worked on it while recuperating from a severe bout of tuberculosis. The sanatorium where he was staying let him set up a lab next to the morgue, and the prototype began to pique the interest of musicians, impressed by its broad palette of sounds and uncanny ability to emulate other instruments.
Trumpet. Basson. Mandoline.
But it would take the talent of a young medical student, whose real dream was to play music, to help the andioline fulfill its potential.
I was studying at the Faculté de Médecine in France, and one day I heard on radio that a man invented an instrument, electronic instrument, able to produce the sounds of instruments, but also a new sound.
The student's name was Jean-Jacques Perrier. Here he is speaking to the BBC in 2004.
And I was possessed by the demon of the music, so I called Georges Jenny, and he was very kind with me, And he said, if you like it so much, so I will lend you one and you can practice it a little bit.
So he came back a few months later and impressed Jenny, I think, no end with very deep facility he'd very quickly developed. It was so impressive that he was instantly taken on as the official demonstrator of the instrument.
But Jean-Jacques Paré wasn't just a salesman. He composed a diverse range of music for the Andelin too. Amongst his early work was the Sombre Prélude au Sommeil, which translates as Prelude to Sleep. Released in 1957, it was presented as a cure for insomnia and was available on prescription from doctors. It's considered one of the first examples of electronic ambient music. And Jean-Jacques' live shows won him some famous fans, including the legendary French filmmaker Jean Cocteau.
Jean Cocteau told me, you should not stay in France because in France you will never be recognized. You have to go to United States.
Heading to the USA in 1960, Jean-Jacques definitely found recognition. And he got a record deal. And he also attracted the attention of the ad men on Madison Avenue, who hired him to help score the music for TV commercials.
Got a cold? They're playing your song. Don't like the arrangement? Then change it. Take Contact. Let those tiny time pills of good medicine put the soft pedal on your sniffles, sneezes, and stuffy nose. One
capsule works. Jean-Jacques Paré broke out of the classical world which defined many of the early electronic musicians, taking new sounds out into the mainstream via the world of commercials.
I think he made music with an unlikely level of joy, just an almost impossible level of joie de vivre about it. Not many people would have managed to put such beautiful humour into music the way he has.
This was, of course, thanks to Georges Genet's Andelin, first conceived in the 1940s. Its catalogue of sounds, emulating other instruments, was a clear precursor to the synthesizers, which would emerge decades later, and which we'll be covering in more detail later in the series.
One thing is clear, without a doubt, Georges Genet was an electronic music genius in terms of his circuit designs, his ideas were just so far out of the box. Obviously, it's predated by perhaps better remembered or more influential instruments like the theremin or the Martineau, the clavier. There were thousands of those instruments made. But Georges Genet developed what I think became the most expressive electronic musical instrument of its time.
Coming up, Germany's avant-garde electronic music movement. And the theremin is revived and becomes the sound of science fiction. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology. This week, I'm telling the story of some of the pioneers of electronic music. Earlier, we heard how artist and inventor Leon Theremin had taken radio technology and repurposed it for making music. And he wasn't the only one. In the aftermath of World War II, there was a hunger for new ideas, a desire to challenge the status quo, which had led the world down a hugely destructive path. And it was in France where a complete reimagining of what music could be began to emerge in a composition style known as musique concrète.
Musique concrète from the real. It's taking real sounds. They were recording in a way that you could think of as being sound effects, steam trains or squeaky doors.
The leading figure in this avant-garde approach to making music was Pierre Schaeffer, who once again worked as a radio engineer. With the latest studio technology on hand, his career began to take a musical diversion. In fact, he was experimenting with gramophone records as early as the 1930s. Sean Williams from the Open University.
They manipulate the playback speed of the records. They would make a little cut in the groove of a record so that once a record had revolved once, the needle would then slip back into the previous groove, thus creating a loop or a repetition. You could play a record backwards. You could do all these sorts of basic manipulations, DJing, effectively.
Pierre Schaeffer's philosophy was that all sounds were potentially musical, not just those created by traditional instruments. For his work titled Five Studies of Noises, he recorded and manipulated sounds as diverse as saucepans, canal boats, and trains. In 1951, he established the Groupe de Recherche de Musique Concrète at the French Radio Institution, and it was in this new studio that he got his hands on the cutting-edge technology of the time, the magnetic tape recorder. Electronic music historian Tom Ray.
The techniques that Schaeffer pioneered, along with some other people there, were things like tape loops, tape reversal, tape speed manipulation. I mean, most early recording studios, it was like, I want to get the best recording that has exactitude, has to sound like what the musicians were playing. Oh, well, that was all gone. The tape recorder became not just a witness, it became a collaborator.
And artists and radio engineers around the world shared this vision for a new type of music.
There was a station in Japan, in Italy, in Brussels. It was all the same all over the world. People wanted to experiment. They wanted to do these things.
And the most significant of these new studios was established in Cologne, home of the Westdeutscher Rundfunk, or WDR, which stands for West German Radio.
After the war, with Germany being divided, there was a big question of how to forge a new identity that didn't really refer to the previous 15 years, politically and especially culturally. What they tried to do was to invent a completely different way of thinking about composing, performing music that was untainted by that recent history. And there was a budget in Cologne, in the Westdeutscher Rundfunk studio, to design this specifically a studio for electronic music.
Among the founders of the studio were Werner Meyer-Eppler, Robert Beyer, and Herbert Eimert. These three men had been talking about new concepts of music since the 1920s, and in 1951 they finally got to open the WDR's electronic music studio.
Zunächst eine Frage, die den technischen Experten angeht. Herr Meyer-Eppler, warum?
They began producing late-night lectures and experimental performances.
Man hat die Bezeichnung elektronische Musik gewählt.
And this man was listening.
I heard about the studio, and heard about the composers, they have heard about the pieces. And in the end, I said, if I want to make electronic music, this is the only way to do it.
Gottfried Michael Koenig had studied classical composition and wrote to the studio asking if he could work with them. He received an invitation and, after completing his studies, made the move to Cologne, where he found a rather different kind of music studio.
It's just a normal cutting room where you have mostly two tape recorders left and right and a small mixing table in the middle where you could listen to recordings made on tape and also work on the tape to make them ready for broadcasting. Nothing else. There weren't any musical instruments at all. Very, very, very simple. Nothing very musical about it.
Housed in a public radio station, the Studio for Electronic Music used the technology at hand to source sound. So equipment meant for testing the broadcast network, sound filters, tone generators and the like, were also used to generate the raw materials for making music.
The primary sound-generating equipment had to be test equipment. There were no synthesizers. They were relying on tone generators. So the most useful kind of tone is a sine wave because it has no harmonics at all. It's just one pure tone, and on a generator you can select exactly what frequency you want. A sine wave sounds something like this. It's very pure. It's not like any musical instrument, although the opposite end of the spectrum from a sine wave, which is absolutely pure, is white noise, and it sounds like this. So you have these two sounds at the opposite ends of the spectrum. Now, something in between is an impulse. An impulse is just a click. And they had impulse generators to generate trains of clicks. You could decide how many you want per second. It's not a terribly interesting sound on its own, but in combination with a filter, a resonant filter, which was another device that they had in the studio, then you can start to create a sound that sort of starts to have a pitch. Well, these are the basic ingredients. Not terribly interesting in their own right, clearly. Once you've got your tape, which contains all the different sine waves, you can make several versions of that, and you can use several tape machines to play all at the same time, to mix those together, to make a really, really complicated sound.
These edited, overdubbed, and distorted sounds were transformed into something never heard before, what became known as electronische Musik. And it was an incredibly painstaking process to put these compositions together. Gottfried Michael Koenig.
There was no improvisation. You couldn't just play. No way. You could only plan beforehand and then put all the bits together afterwards. The composer, he just came to the institute any morning with a sheet of paper with all the data he needed for the sounds he wanted to make, for the frequencies, the decibels, for the loudness, the durations, and so on.
Then using the tape machines as their principal tool, producers like Gottfried would record sounds onto tape, sometimes multiple tapes, and then rearrange them by speeding up or slowing down the sounds, or cutting tapes together to create their stark sound collages.
Recording some sounds coming from the apparatus on tape and cut it up into little pieces and put those little pieces together again, 5 seconds or something. And this little piece of transformed in many different ways. You could stretch it in time, you could shorten it in time, you could put it into an echo chamber, so that it is a multi-layered result.
Composers might spend a year or more creating a piece of music which was only 12 or 13 minutes long. And while some of you might be thinking it can't be that hard to make a bunch of bleeps and bloops, there's a hidden complexity to this.
It sounds weird because it doesn't use the same kind of rules that we're used to, but that doesn't mean it doesn't use any rules at all. A lot of the music that was made in the German studio comes under the sort of heading integral serialism, where there are particular lists of numbers that are transformed and applied to frequency or to amplitude or to duration or to all these sorts of parameters. There is a lot that's happening. There are all kinds of connections. It's highly structured, it's highly organized. And in some sense, if you approach it as if it's a kind of a cryptic crossword, then that can be a really interesting way of trying to listen to it.
While perhaps an acquired taste, the composers of the Cologne studio garnered worldwide acclaim, albeit in more avant-garde academic circles. Front and centre was Karlheinz Stockhausen. Stockhausen had studied in Paris, where he was exposed to musique concrète, before returning home to Germany in 1954, when he joined the WDR, and would go on to become its director a decade later.
There were a number of incredible composers that worked in the NWDR. You've got Gyorgy Ligeti from Hungary, you've got Maurizio Kagel from Argentina. But Stockhausen is the poster boy, therefore was able to exercise his authority on the direction of the studio. He was also incredibly prolific, also very good at the politics to be able to have things funded. It's not cheap, any of this. For one of the filters that they used to make a voice sound like it's on the telephone in the 50s, the equivalent price in today's money could be anywhere between $30,000 to $40,000. And that's just one item, never mind the tape machines.
While the Cologne studio tore up the rule book when it came to composition, they also redefined the role of the composer, In the past, composing complex music required the support of an orchestra and singers for it to be brought to life. At the Cologne studio, the composers realized they didn't need anyone else.
It's actually very simple. It's at the beginning, a composer has no connections whatsoever, no instrumentalists, no conductors, no orchestras. You just have your paper and pencil and you write music down. Okay, yeah, you can write it down, but you can't hear it. So what was fascinating about electronic music is that you can not only compose music, but hear it at the same time. You don't need conductors or orchestras or musicians. It's the position of a painter. You are alone with your work. You can finish it without anybody helping you. You are not only composers, but instrument makers at the same time.
This is an idea that goes back as far as 1624, even. The philosopher, scientist, author Francis Bacon wrote a piece called The New Atlantis, which described, really uncannily, the kinds of ideas that were really only able to be done in the 50s and onwards. He describes devices that could create echoes and ways of giving the sound back louder than it started and conveying sound by pipes and tubes and all these sorts of things. It's also echoed in the journal that was being produced in the Westdeutsche Rundfunk in the first issue of this in 1955. It's talking about music conceived purely for the electronic sound generator and which for its realisation does not require, indeed excludes, human interpreters.
While talk of mechanical orchestras and intelligent electronic sound generators might seem the stuff of science fiction, by the 1950s, electronic music was science fiction, or at least the soundtrack to it.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon, the arrival of a spaceship in Washington.
In 1951, composer Bernard Herrmann revived the theremin to provide the sinister tones for a Hollywood sci-fi classic, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Leon Theremin had scored films himself back in Russia in the 1920s, but the big bucks of Hollywood brought new opportunities for American artists who had been fashioning experimental music on the fringes.
The 50s is beginning to look like a golden age. There was freedom in the arts. So people were putting all their creativity, all their hopes and dreams into the arts.
Louis and B.B. Baron were a husband and wife team who had built an electronic music studio in New York's Greenwich Village.
We were making the end of the world type sounds day after day at the highest level we could possibly achieve. Nobody cared.
Electronic music historian Tom Ray.
Their big idea was cybernetics. The Barons built these circuits that lived and died. They felt like they had a life. You know, and when it died, they didn't try to resurrect it. It made sounds, and if it gurgled off to oblivion, they didn't bother. They just built something else.
We would record everything that came out of the circuits.
And as soon as the circuit began to do something interesting, which might take days,
in 1956, a Hollywood producer named Dory Sherry was visiting New York and happened across the Barons performing in Greenwich Village. Amazed by what he heard, he hired them on the spot to compose music for a new sci-fi film he was making called The Forbidden Planet. It would become the first ever fully electronic film score.
When I heard that soundtrack as a 12-year-old, it came out in 56, I determined, I want to do that. I want to do that. So Forbidden Planet affected many, many people personally. I had seen before Forbidden Planet, The Day the Earth Stood Still. Electronic instruments had two theremins in it. Very avant-garde. You'll go to a film, you'll tolerate much more avant-garde music than if you were sitting in a concert hall. A lot of what we hear has come in the back door through films.
But not everyone was a fan. Hollywood had always relied on big orchestras to provide the soundtracks to their films, and the Musicians Union feared the advent of semi-automated electronic music would put its members out of work. Producer Dory Sherry tried to placate them by saying it wasn't really music, but electronic tonalities. But the union didn't buy it, and it meant the end of the Baron's Hollywood career.
We could never get a job after that in this town because it turned out that MGM had made an agreement with the Musicians Union that we didn't even know about until quite a bit later, saying they would never hire us again, that they had hired us for a special situation that couldn't be done by a union. At that time, the union was very powerful. So we did a lot of plays on Broadway, but that's not at all the same. Nobody knows or cares about.
By the 1960s, electronic music was about to get a lot more complicated, thanks to the transistor, considered by many to be the most important invention of the 20th century. Put very basically, it's a switch, a function previously performed by bulky, unreliable vacuum tubes. An invention of the 1940s, by the 1960s they had dropped dramatically in price and size and allowed for much more complex circuitry. And there was one man who really put it to use in the advance of electronic music. Raymond Scott was a star. He was in a band, he was on TV and the radio.
Here's Raymond Scott with a quintet in a dynamic version of his own composition, Our House.
Well, he was in view. The first part of his career was very visible. He ran the Lucky Strike hit parade, had very famous tunes on the radio, and he had the Raymond Scott Quintet. It was actually a sextet, but Raymond didn't like the word sextet. It probably because he was of a generation that he thought sex was unnecessary to say publicly. But I think in the later part of his career, it's almost like been there, done that, want to do this other thing and new worlds to conquer.
The music you are listening to is completely electronic and has been created and produced on equipment designed and manufactured by Manhattan Research, a division of Raymond Scott Enterprises, Incorporated.
Raymond Scott founded Manhattan Research just after World War II, and it was the base for his experiments in electronics. Some of his early inventions included an electronic keyboard called the Clavivox, which was based on theremin technology. And by the 1960s, Manhattan Research had become a significant operation. Herb Deutsch had himself been producing electronic music while in college in the early 60s and managed to wangle a visit to Scott's New York HQ.
He was living and working in an industrial section on Long Island called Willow Park. They were building things that I didn't know of, electronic devices, electronic music things. And then Raymond came out and he said, come on into the studio. I just stopped at the door and I could not believe what I saw. The best recording equipment, the newest and most modern electronics. There were a couple of musical instruments in there that I had heard of from the 1930s, an on the Martineau. I had never seen, but I heard about it, and there were a lot of things.
In 1963, Raymond Scott released a collection of three electronic albums titled Soothing Sounds for Baby, a series of ethereal electronic lullabies. But the bulk of his work was focused on something else entirely, making money.
His mind was focused on the most commercial thing I can do. That's very important when you think of Raymond Scott, because he was a brilliant commercial composer. The music that he did for jingles was unlike and better than most electronic music I could hear. But they were a minute long at the most, and they never went anywhere musically. They went everywhere interestingly.
The first spark plug that cleans itself while you drive. Pow! And it's Autoline, Autoline, Autoline!
What Raymond Scott had built was an electronic music factory. He wasn't slaving over a few minutes of music for months on end, like the avant-garde composers of Cologne. Instead, he was building machines which could write musical sequences for him.
basically what sequence is a melodic idea, which is then developed. And it's developed by changing its pitch key. And I'm the worst singer in the world, but I can do that by singing a little bit. Da 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 dee da 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 could become da 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 dee da dee dum, or dee da 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 dee da da. You know, can be turned upside down, but it's using melodic ideas and repeating them in sequential manners.
This is one. This is step number one. Number two.
All of the work that Raymond Scott was doing was based on the fact that he had incredible control of the sequencing of the ideas that he created.
This is three.
He would create a sound and it would then follow sequences of different versions of that sound, and it was all done on a huge wall of electronic switches, which all clicked on and off. And when you were in the studio, you heard the music. When you walked out and went behind the wall, you heard nothing but this amazing amount of clicks.
At the center of Raymond Scott's musical laboratory was the Electronium, a machine which he had under constant development. Scott was hugely protective of his ideas, but Tom Ray was allowed a peek at Scott's pride and joy in 1972.
I met Raymond Scott when I was doing dissertation research, and he made me sign a disclosure, you know, I wouldn't disclose anything. Very, very secretive, paranoid even. And if you think about a console that's curved sort of around you, 2.5 meters wide, totally. Myriad switches and dials and lights. And I was privileged to actually hear him interact with it. Well, let me have the Electronium suggest a theme. But you had no clue what it would be, and neither did he. And it was anything but Raymond dictating. It was a collaborator. One of the few people that I would actually count as a genius. A genius is somebody who's mind is different in kind, not just degree. Probing impossible things, putting connections together that other people don't see. That's a genius, and I think Raymond was one.
Raymond Scott's genius was also noticed by Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown Records. Seduced by the idea of a songwriting machine, he reportedly sunk over $1 million into its development. It's unlikely the Electronium ever produced a hit, but its influence faded as it was overtaken by faster, cheaper, and more complex technology. By the 1970s, electronic music was everywhere, with the advent of electronic organs and synthesizers. What was once avant-garde had now become mainstream and was no longer the unique domain of visionaries like Leon Theremin, the Barons, and Raymond Scott. Since then, electronic music has expanded and diversified into its own subsets, from techno to trance, drum and bass to dubstep. But it's worth remembering, this music we think of as being so thoroughly modern is now over 100 years old. Coming up next time, the electric guitar.
For me, a guitar looks and feels like a woman.
It seemed to come from another dimension.
I feel complete when I'm holding a guitar.
But for now, thanks for listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The programme was mixed by James Beard and produced by Richard Fenton-Smith. The editor is Jasper Corbett. This programme was made in association with the Open University.